space to devote herself to Polly's autobiography, which she spent the last few years, Polly's life, writing very seriously. In one interview, we heard Polly was introduced as a lawyer turned poet. She said, "No, I'm a poet turned lawyer." For Polly, writing was probably the most important form of expression. Polly had written an amazing family memoir, Proud Shoes, which is kind of like the precursor to Roots, an extraordinary story of her own family, mainly in the 19th century, and then went on to finish her autobiography, which was extremely important to Polly.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there, but people should begin to explore. Betsy West and Julie Cohen are the award-winning directors of the new documentary, My Name is Polly Murray, premiering at the Sundance Film Festival virtually this weekend. Thanks also to Dolores Chandler, the former coordinator of the Polly Murray Center in Durham, featured in the film. That does it for our broadcast. Democracy Now! Produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Libby Rainey, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Carla Wills, Tammy Warnoff, Charina Dudura, Sam Alcock, Tim Maria Studio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Honey Masood, and Adriana Contura. Special thanks to Julie Crosby and Becca Staley. I'm Amy Goodman. Be safe. Wear a mask. Try.
Tuned in to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Talk and Taste, Getting Vaccinated for the Love of Health, hosted by Preserve Coalition. On Wednesday, February 10th, from 1:30 to 3:30 p.m., streaming online. Talk and Taste is a virtual afternoon of engaging activities, cooking demonstrations, informative talks, and dance and exercise lessons hosted by LaTroy Robinson. Again, that's Talk and Taste, Getting Vaccinated for the Love of Health, hosted by Preserve Coalition, on Wednesday, February 10th, from 1:30 to 3:30 p.m., streaming online. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, city and county leaders have asked the state for help in addressing the growing crisis of houselessness in Portland. Republican state legislators have repudiated the Oregon GOP's position that the January 6th Capitol riots were a false flag event. And consultants say that the Portland Police Bureau has not done a comprehensive review of its crowd control tactics. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, January 29th, 2021. I'm Nat Moon. Leaders in both Portland and Multnomah County have asked for help from the state in dealing with the increase in houselessness resulting from the COVID-19 pandemic. They are also calling for help to prevent additional people from becoming houseless. The result came during a Thursday Senate Committee on Housing and Development meeting. Local leaders cannot say exactly how many people are living on the streets because the biennial point-in-time count has been postponed, but Multnomah County Chair Deborah Kafuri said, quote, "There are more tents on the street, and we're assuming that more people are out there." The city and county have spent millions on the houselessness crisis since the pandemic began, but more is needed. Mayor Ted Wheeler said, quote, "The safety nets were strained before, but I think we can all agree the pandemic blew those safety nets apart, and the result is more people falling into homelessness in our communities." He went on to say, quote, "We need money for rent assistance, resources for long-term rent support, and flexibility for temporary and alternative shelters. City tenants could owe as much as $200 million in back rent since the start of the pandemic." That's according to an analysis by the Portland Housing Bureau. The majority of Portland's merchants believe that the city center is no longer safe. That's according to a recently completed survey. 62% of downtown business owners responded that the area no longer feels safe to them. This is three times the number of negative responses compared to a similar survey in 2018. The poll was conducted by the nonprofit Downtown Portland Clean and Safe between November 15th and December 31st of last year. Survey takers were asked to rate their concerns. Although public safety was a major concern, the pandemic was by far the biggest single factor. It was cited by 41% of the respondents. Other major concerns for Portland merchants included cleanliness, houselessness, and addiction, and vandalism. More than half the business owners cited a decline in revenue for 2020, and over one-third said it would take more than 3 years for their businesses to recover. One-third of the businesses said they plan to relocate in the next 2 years, but 6% said they would take another space downtown. Independent consultants have found that the Portland Police Bureau has not done a detailed review of the crowd control tactics used during protests. In their fourth quarter report, the firm of Rosenbaum & Associates observed that officers sometimes could not explain their use of force, and some officers didn't have sufficient information to determine if their use of force was reasonable. Use of force included tear gas, so-called less lethal munitions, pepper spray, and attacking people with batons. Officers are supposed to complete a report at the end of their shift if force is used, but some officers couldn't describe the behavior that prompted their use of force. The latest report says that the PPB continues to be out of compliance, particularly in regards to the reporting and review of how officers use force. Portland is required to monitor and evaluate the police reforms that were required under the 2014 settlement agreement with the U.S. Department of Justice. The report notes that there are times when force is necessary, but goes on to say that, quote, "At times, no distinction was made between persons engaging in serious criminal acts and those who, while unlawfully remaining in an exclusion zone, posed no threat and offered no resistance," end quote. The consultants stated that Portland police used force over 6,000 times during protests and made more than 1,000 arrests. A number of demonstrators were injured and numerous lawsuits have since been filed. The report also noted that more than 600 officers reported injuries during the protests, including broken bones, cuts, and bruises. In many ways, the report by Rosenbaum & Associates reinforces the opinion of U.S. District Court Judge Marco Hernandez. Earlier this month, he found the city in contempt of his order restricting the use of so-called less lethal weapons for crowd control during protests. The PPB is working on their own review of the Bureau's crowd control responses during the protests, but no date has been given for its release. Bureau spokesperson Sergeant Kevin Allen said, quote, "The protests lasted 6 months and involved a lot of resources, so the comprehensive review will take some time." Critics say big dairy farms produce a massive amount of waste and pollution, and new bills in the Oregon legislature would hit pause on those facilities. With more on the story, here's Eric Tegedoff of the Oregon News Service.
Critics say big dairy farms produce a massive amount of waste and pollution, and bills in the Oregon legislature would hit pause on these facilities. The measures place a moratorium on licenses for dairy operations with more than 2,500 cows. Emma Newton is the Oregon organizer for Food and Water Watch and also organizes the Stand Up to Factory Farms Coalition. She says in 2019, Oregon's mega dairies produced 6.5 billion pounds of manure, more than twice the waste from the Portland metro area.
This is really an issue that's happening now. We've been dealing with it for a while. We have one of the largest in the country, and these bills would really just give us a time out and allow us to address the issues from these facilities.
Dairy is a $1 billion industry in Oregon, and the industry says the moratorium threatens jobs. Lauren Goldberg with Columbia Riverkeeper says the lax regulations for mega dairies is attracting more massive operations to the state.
The state treats large-scale industrial operations as though they're small-time family farms, when in fact they are massive polluters of both groundwater and surface water.
In 2017, a 30,000-cow operation in Boardman racked up more than 200 environmental violations before being shut down in 2018. Now, Easterday Farms is proposing a mega dairy, the second largest in the state, on the same site. Oregon Public Broadcasting reports the same family behind these plans is being sued for allegedly defrauding Tyson Meats in Washington State. Newton says her coalition has heard from communities directly impacted by mega dairies. They say they shouldn't have to choose between jobs and a healthy environment.
The burden of mega dairy pollution and where these facilities are sited is in communities that are often communities of color, Black, Indigenous communities of color, and the burden is really carried by them.
House Bill 2924 and Senate Bill 583 both are in committee. Newton hopes they receive a public hearing soon. For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Republican legislators in Oregon are attempting to distance themselves from the state party after the GOP leadership labeled the January 6th Capitol riots as a false flag operation. In a letter dated January 19th, party leaders called the storming of the U.S. Capitol a, quote, false flag operation designed to discredit President Trump and conservative Republicans. The letter compared the Capitol riot to the burning of the Reichstag, Hitler's excuse for the Nazi takeover of Germany in 1933. But on Wednesday, all 23 Oregon House Republicans signed a letter repudiating the party's position, saying, quote, there is no credible evidence to support false flag claims. The legislators said that their focus was on recovery from the pandemic and the rollout of the vaccine, and concluded by saying, quote, the election is over, it's time to govern. The claim that the Capitol riot was a false flag has been debunked by federal officials and numerous news agencies. More than 150 people have been arrested so far, with many having connections to ultra-right-wing organizations such as the Proud Boys and the Three Percenters. In a written response to the legislators, Oregon Republican Party Chairperson Bill Currier continued to express concerns over alleged election irregularities, but admitted that the election was over. But the GOP chair did not completely back off the false flag allegations, saying, quote, we have a difference of opinion over whether credible evidence is emerging regarding potential false flag occurrences on January 6th, end quote. The Portland Public School System announced future plans as well as a timeline for returning to in-person teaching for area students. Based on updated guidelines from the Oregon Department of Education, PPS Chief of Systems Performance, Dr. Russell Brown, said the changes, quote, would support an immediate expansion of in-person services for students. This week, PPS teachers and staff are receiving COVID-19 vaccines, and according to PPS Superintendent Guadalupe Guerrero, those vaccinations will be complete by the end of February. The expectation is that there will be limited in-person education in 45 schools by February 22nd and all school sites by March 1st. School administrators are identifying eligible students and advising families that a return to school is optional. Guerrero targeted April 1st as the date that hybrid learning would be available to most students. Hybrid learning mixes days of in-classroom instruction with remote learning. PPS also announced an expanded summer school program that would allow more students to participate. They also plan to expand athletics with a possible return to modified practice, as well as adding outdoor options for high school choirs and bands starting in February. The district did not address how it will implement hybrid learning at the high school level while still adhering to state guidelines. In response to concerns about air quality in aging school buildings, parents were told that the district has ordered 400 air purifiers and is working with safety and air quality experts to address their concerns. Yesterday, Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler announced that former Mayor Sam Adams will be joining his administration. Adams is viewed as an experienced City Hall veteran and has been designated Director of Strategic Innovations. In making the announcement, Wheeler said, quote, "Sam's knowledge of Portland City Hall and his track record of action and getting things done is much welcome," end quote. The former mayor will focus on houseless folks and street camping, public safety, cleaning up graffiti and garbage, and addressing economic fallout from the ongoing pandemic. Adams starts on Monday, February 1st, and will report to Wheeler's Deputy Chief of Staff, Sonia Szymanski. Adams was a single-term city commissioner prior to becoming Portland's mayor from 2009 through 2012, but his term was hampered by charges that he lied about a sexual relationship with a teenager that began while he was commissioner. Adams did not seek a second term. On Thursday, Wheeler also announced that Dr. Markeisha Smith will serve as a special advisor to the mayor on racial justice and equity while continuing to lead the city's Office of Equity and Human Rights. In a statement, Dr. Smith said, quote, "I look forward to helping Mayor Wheeler and council further institutionalize equity in the city's policies and culture," end quote. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Coming up next at 5:30, it's Counterspin, your look behind the headlines. Stick around at 6 for Rising Up with Sana Lee. Tonight, we can expect light rain overnight with temperatures in the low 40s. Tomorrow, we'll see a rainy day with a high of about 48. On this day in 1926, Violet Neatley Anderson became the first African-American woman admitted to practice law before the U.S. Supreme Court. Today's quote is from the late Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who said, quote, "When I'm sometimes asked, when will there be enough women on the Supreme Court, and I say, when there are 9, people are shocked, but there'd been 9 men, and nobody's ever raised a question about that." Reform advocates are pushing the Democratic majority in the Senate to end the filibuster. They say that the filibuster allows a minority of senators representing a small percentage of the U.S. population to control the legislative agenda. For more on that, here's Andrea Sears with the Public News Service.
Although Democrats now have a razor-thin majority in the U.S. Senate, political reform advocates say to pass progressive legislation, they first will have to eliminate the filibuster. By requiring a 60-vote majority to bring most legislation to a vote in the Senate, the filibuster rule allows a minority of senators to block important legislation. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell has tried to force Democrats to promise to keep that rule now that they hold the majority, but according to Ellie Zupnik with the group Fix Our Senate, leaving the filibuster in place will invite a repetition of the political obstruction that took place during the Obama administration.
If the filibuster is allowed to continue to exist, then Mitch McConnell will continue to be able to stop anything that voters just handed Democrats the power to implement.
Supporters of the filibuster say it ensures conservatives will have a place in negotiations, but opponents counter that it allows a few senators to stop legislation vital to the interests of all Americans, including New Yorkers. Supnik says New York Senator Charles Schumer, the new majority leader, is trying to make sure bills to protect public health and rebuild an economy devastated by the COVID pandemic can get to the Senate floor for a vote and have a chance to pass.
Senator Schumer has shown great leadership in pushing back against Mitch McConnell's demands to protect the filibuster and enshrine that in the Senate rules right from the start of this new Senate.
He adds that while there are now 50 senators from each party, Senate Democrats actually represent far more voters than do the Republicans. With many Democrats coming from more densely populated states, they represent tens of millions more voters than their counterparts across the aisle. Supnik says the filibuster supercharges that imbalance.
It makes it so that a tiny minority of senators, sometimes senators representing just 13% of the American people, can block the will of the vast majority of Americans and stop legislation that's overwhelmingly popular from being implemented.
If every Democrat agrees, they could eliminate the filibuster by using what's called the nuclear option, changing the Senate rule with a simple 51-vote majority. For Public News Service, I'm Andrea Sears.
Yesterday, President Joe Biden signed executive orders aimed at health care. With more on the story and others, it's Laura Rosborough-Tallum with 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we're tracking our democracy in historic times. President Joe Biden signed another executive order yesterday, this time for health care.
To undo the damage Trump has done, there's nothing new that we're doing here other than restoring the Affordable Care Act and restoring the Medicaid.
First, Biden is reopening enrollment in the ACA marketplaces to give more people a chance to get health insurance. Over 2.2 million lost theirs in the first 3 years of the Trump administration. The new period starts February 15th and is open till May 15th. The Biden administration is also reviewing former President Donald Trump policies undermining protections for those with pre-existing medical conditions. Biden has told federal agencies to revise the Trump policies that made it harder to qualify for Medicaid, the public health insurance program for people with disabilities or low incomes, including potentially removing states' work requirements.
Of all times that we need to reinstate access to, affordability of, and extent of access to Medicaid is now in the middle of this COVID crisis.
Medicaid enrollment has risen since the pandemic began, after dropping between 2017 and 2019, attributed to reduced funding for public outreach. Biden's executive order this week ending the federal use of private prisons did not include privately run immigration facilities, where the ACLU says, as of a year ago, 81% of people detained in ICE custody were held. One of the nation's largest is the Northwest ICE Processing Center in Tacoma, Washington. Maru Mora Villalpando is a community organizer with the group La Resistencia.
This is not the solution to the immigration detention enterprise that has been built. And now we have to push him and his entire administration to start phasing out private detention and ultimately close all detention centers.
Looking ahead, Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi says she hopes to move a COVID relief package forward quickly.
I'll bring a budget resolution to the floor next week, and then it will send it over to the Senate. By the end of the week, we will be finished with the budget resolution, which will be about reconciliation, if needed. I hope we don't need it, but if needed, we will have it.
Budget reconciliation is a procedure which lets the Senate pass legislation with a simple majority, rather than the usual 60 votes required to end debate and get to a vote. It's only for bills that focus on federal budgetary spending or taxes and cannot include unrelated provisions. Yesterday, House Republican leader California's Kevin McCarthy met with former President Donald Trump in Florida to discuss the twice-impeached politician's plans for the 2022 midterm elections. After record-low approval ratings following the Capitol insurrection, a morning consult and Politico poll this week had 50% of Republican voters saying Trump should play a major role in the GOP going forward. Eric Tegedoff contributed reporting. For Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Laura Rosborough-Tallum. Thanks for listening.
There is outrage in Canada after a wealthy couple in British Columbia jumped the queue and received vaccinations intended for the First Nation. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Canada's Indigenous Services Minister is warning people against schemes to get COVID-19 vaccines after a wealthy British Columbia couple flew to the Yukon for vaccinations intended for a First Nation. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, the incident has caused outrage as government and Native leaders speak out.
Rod and Ekaterina Baker each face fines of $1,150 for allegedly failing to self-isolate and failing to behave in a manner consistent with the declarations made on their arrival in Yukon. The multimillionaire couple chartered a plane to Beaver Creek, Yukon, the home of the White River First Nation. They claim to be local workers in order to obtain vaccinations. Remote communities such as Beaver Creek are prioritized for early vaccinations. Indigenous Services Minister Mark Miller says there is a scarcity of doses and this shouldn't have happened.
That was the most idiotic thing I've seen in weeks. I understand these people are wealthy. I won't tell them what to do with their money, but perhaps reparations are due of some level.
Most people who enter Yukon for non-essential reasons must also provide a 14-day isolation plan. Officials say the couple did not follow the territory's isolation rules. Dr. Bonnie Henry is the health officer for British Columbia.
I think they should be ashamed of themselves. They put a community at risk for their own benefit, and that to me is appalling.
Many people in the community and across the Yukon are angry over the incident. The Assembly of First Nations says Rod Baker owes a moral debt to the First Nation. Baker has since resigned as the CEO of casino operator Great Canadian Gaming. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
Researchers have confirmed the location of an important site in Tlingit history in Southeast Alaska's Sitka National Historical Park. KCAW's Aaron McKinstry has more.
A peaceful clearing, a plaque, and a totem pole mark the spot where Shishkinu, or the Fort of Young Saplings, once stood.
It's a sacred place, and I have been going out there for years when I feel in the need of strength.
Louise Brady is Kiksetti from the Point House in Sitka.
I go out there because that's where my ancestors died, for this land and for us.
The fort was built following the Battle of Old Sitka in 1802, when the Kiksetti ousted Russian colonists from a site around 7 miles north. They anticipated the Russian return 2 years later and held off invaders from the fort for 4 days, until the loss of their gunpowder supply ultimately forced them to retreat and abandon the site. Oral histories and archaeological evidence pointed to the clearing near the mouth of the Indian River, but some thought the fort stood in a different part of the park. A study released this week in the journal Antiquity has dispelled those doubts. Tommy Urban is a research scientist at Cornell University and the study's co-author.
We did such a large survey, you know, much larger than the area immediately around the fort clearing, you know, because we wanted to rule out these other possibilities that it could be located somewhere else in the park.
Urban used something called an electromagnetic induction unit, which works kind of like a metal detector, to survey more than 40 acres of park property by hand over the course of 2 weeks. He also used a tool called a ground-penetrating radar. The technologies helped Urban and co-author Brennan Carter determine the exact outline of the wooden fort, which was slightly larger than the current clearing and shaped like a trapezoid. Brady of the Kiksetti clan says it's reassuring to know with certainty where the fort once stood.
Now we know for sure that this is the place that this happened, and let's learn more, and let's learn more together.
Brady says she's always pleased when scientific and technological findings align with oral histories. I'm Erin McKinstry.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
A bill making it illegal for South Dakotans to change the sex designation on their birth certificate is working its way through the state legislature, and LGBTQ advocates are fighting back. For more on that story, here's Mike Moen with the Public News Service.
Advocates for the transgender community continue to speak out against a bill that would block South Dakotans from changing the sex designation on their birth certificates. The measure cleared the lower chamber and the legislature earlier this week, despite being initially rejected by a House committee. Supporters of the bill say it's about maintaining vital records for government business and is not intended as a form of hate. But Tony Diamond of the Black Hills Center for Equality says it adds to a hostile attitude toward the LGBTQ community from some state lawmakers. Diamond, a transgender woman, says her experience shows there's no need for this type of law change.
I was able to legally change my gender marker on my birth certificate and on all my legal documentation. And when I go to a doctor appointment or when I go to fill out an application, my ID shows that I am Tony Diamond, female.
She says the only thing it would do is open the door to discrimination towards younger transgender residents. Representative Fred Deutsch, the bill's sponsor, has introduced other legislation in recent years that has angered advocates. And transgender bills have surfaced in other states this year, including one in neighboring Montana that bans trans students from playing a school sport. And even though conservative politics hold heavy weight in South Dakota, Diamond says in Rapid City she doesn't feel any backlash. She feels it's time for lawmakers fearful of change to stop clinging to an old standard and recognize a changing society.
What the state is missing out on is people that are willing to contribute to society in all levels, be it in government, be it in the school systems, be it just working any kind of 9-to-5 job.
Instead, Diamond says these bills that continue to surface keep the LGBTQ community in hiding or wanting to leave South Dakota. Groups like the ACLU of South Dakota say they will fight the measure in court if it clears the remaining legislative hurdles and is signed into law. Mike Moen, Humlick News Service.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Friday, January 29th, 2021. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our producer for tonight's newscast is Ray Bodwell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Eric Tegedoff, Antonia Gonzalez, and Laura Rosbro-Tellum. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR